they have another chance. Here's Ashley.
Hey, everybody. Good to have you here on a Monday. Hello. Welcome to the program. It's a big Monday. I say that because one of the biggest stories that we've been covering and bringing to you for the last 2.5 years is the Idaho quadruple murders. And for the longest time, it was a desert of information because of the gag order. But now we get big drops of information. Suddenly, there's a document that drops and there are details in there we had no idea existed. And the pieces of the puzzle are coming together. Tonight is no different. We are learning, and this blew my mind, that the two surviving roommates actually did see one of their roommates lying on the floor in her room. This flies in the face of everything we thought till now. We thought that Zanna Kernodle's bedroom door was locked, that they were banging on the door, that they could not get in, that they called 911 thinking she was passed out. Oh, no, no. No, no, they saw her lying on the floor. And then got real scared. I'm going to put some of these pieces together for you. Also, something else that just, I think about it and I just imagine what could have been, but the roommates were all having a conversation at 2 a.m. before Zanna got home with Ethan. So Bethany and Dylan and Maddie and Kaylee, they were all talking about going out again at 2 a.m. Imagine if they'd gone out again. Maybe they wouldn't have been there. Maybe they would have. Anyway, I've got Kaylee's dad on tonight because he's learning a lot of this stuff too, and he knows some things that we don't know. So I'm going to have a big conversation with him, especially about a detail he learned about his daughter that was very disturbing, something that the killer did. And that's coming in just a moment. And then in the Karen Reed trial, this is one of my favorite things about trials, the battle of the nerds. I say that because so often testimony can be really boring when they get like the AT&T guy on the stand and the text message guy on the stand, but not in Karen Reed's case. Oh no, there is a battle of the nerds between the time 2:27 a.m. and 6:23 a.m. And those two times mean all the difference because they can mean time for that lady. If we can't figure out the difference between these two times with a Google search, how long to die in the cold, well, it could mean she either walks or she gets locked up. I will explain why digital evidence isn't so cut and dry. It's open to interpretation, weirdly, and the battle of the nerds on the stand could mean the difference. And then, do you remember when I told you the story of the bassist for the band Weezer? I actually love Weezer. Love the way they did the song Africa. The wife of the bassist had the weirdest thing happen in L.A. about a month ago. She got in a shootout with, like, LAPD. None of us could understand what in the heck was going on, but she got shot in the shoulder, and then she got arrested for attempted murder of a cop. It was nuts. It was absolutely nuts. And we've all wondered what happened that day. Now we think we know. And we've got the video to back it up. And I think she did not know who she was shooting at. She thought she was shooting at bad guys. Then the police thought she knew they were cops shooting at them. So I'm going to show you the body cam. You can decide for yourself. Here's a quick snippet, though. Take a look at this. I'll talk in a minute.
Drop the gun! You're gonna get shot! You're getting shot! It's the police!
Yeah, I can't see who's behind that fence either, right? Can you? Turns out she thought that the people behind that fence may have been the bad guys who the police were actually chasing. It's very complicated, but it's actually really cool when you get down on the ground and you get that body cam view. So I'm gonna show it all to you coming up. Let me start here, though. In my business, we're laser focused on learning every detail and filling in every blank about a gripping true crime case. But sometimes in this process, our hearts just get broken all over again each time we learn something new. And so it is with the University of Idaho murders. Since the case moved to Boise with a different judge, we've seen a blizzard of unsealed, unredacted court filings and a regular supply of details and disclosures, even some bombshells. And tonight, two absolutely stunning revelations about the surviving housemates texting and talking in the wee hours of November 13th, 2022. Also, a rare peek into some grand jury testimony, something we don't often get to see. We knew that Dylan Mortensen, a surviving roommate, had texted an Uber driver just after 2 o'clock in the morning. That's about 2 hours before the murders happened. But now we know that she and three of her roommates, Bethany, Kaylee, and Maddie, all of whom had just arrived home from a night out, had actually contemplated going out again. The court document reads, and I quote, at approximately 2 a.m., they met up in Kaylee's bedroom and talked for a while before going to bed. The fifth roommate, Zanna Kernodle, who was out with her boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, was not home yet. The roommates debated going out to the food truck for late night snack, prompting Dylan to send a text at 2:10 a.m. to an Uber driver she knew to see if he was driving. Ultimately, however, the girls decided to just go to bed. Man, that brings to mind a lot of what ifs, doesn't it? What if they'd gone back out? What if they just decided, let's go, let's do it. It's 2 a.m., let's go get more food. Might that have changed the course of history on that horrifying night? Of course, there is a good chance that they'd pop back out to that food trunk, that they still would have been home before the knife-wielding intruder, allegedly Brian Koberger, broke in and killed Kaylee, Maddie, Zanna, and Ethan. But we will never know. And that brings me to the second revelation. We knew about Dylan and Bethany's frantic text messaging between 4:22 a.m. and 4:26 a.m. when Dylan tells Bethany that nobody will answer their phones and that she's afraid because she saw someone in a ski mask. And we knew that Dylan then ran down to Bethany's room on the ground floor of the three-level house. But the court documents now reveal a brand new fact that we never knew. And it is, honestly, it is something horrifying. Again, quoting Dylan. Dylan again tried calling Kaylee and Zanna, but neither responded. Dylan then exited her room and began running towards Bethany's bedroom. On her way, she noticed Zanna lying on the floor of her bedroom with her head towards the wall and her feet towards the door. Dylan thought Zanna was drunk. Once Dylan arrived downstairs at Bethany's room, they locked the door and both made additional unanswered calls to the other roommates. Hours passed, and at 11:50 a.m. the next morning, 6 minutes before the 911 call that you have heard on this program, Dylan called her friends Emily Allant and Hunter Johnson because she was too afraid to go upstairs by herself. And the court filing reads, Emily and Hunter met Dylan and Bethany at the bottom floor of the house. Together, Dylan, Bethany, and Hunter started to walk up the stairs to the second floor. When they reached the second floor, Hunter went to the kitchen to grab a kitchen knife. Now, this next part is from Dylan's grand jury testimony. When Hunter came back out, Dylan said, quote, she saw Zanna again for a split second. And this is Dylan talking, and just started bawling because she thought she had just like, I don't even know. I thought maybe she was just still just drunk and all asleep on the floor. Bethany also saw Zanna lying on the floor. Hunter told Dylan and Bethany to, quote, get out. Emily, who had started up the stairs, also turned around after Hunter instructed her not to come any further. They both went outside shortly afterwards, and Hunter exited the house and then told them to call 911. He was pale, white, and mentioned something about someone being unconscious. You can hear a lot of that, you know. You can hear a lot of it on the 911 call. We just envisioned that the banging and the calling out, Zanna, Ethan, was at the bedroom door. But it may not have been. It may have been down the hall and around the corner at the stairs. This is where I'm going to stop and bring in Steve Gonzalez. Steve is Kaylee Gonzalez's father. He's been a regular guest on the program. Steve, these were details that I found astounding. They seemed to put into place more details of a very confusing picture of what happened that night. And I often stop and I think about you and the other parents and whether you get a heads up that this stuff is coming, whether you have someone who sits down with you and goes through it and helps you to sort through it. How do you receive this kind of information?
We normally get an email beforehand. We work back and forth. I don't think either party really had an understanding of how to really construct something where you can share information, but not too much information. But the communication's gotten a lot better. I've really grew to like these guys. I mean, I really care about those people and all the work that they've done. So I think they've always tried to work towards communication, but I'm sure they're very busy, and it's not easy to always remember to keep us in the loop.
You know, it was a surprise to me, Steve, to hear this detail that Bethany got a glimpse down the hall of what now appears to be Zanna's open bedroom door and Zanna lying inside that bedroom door and ran downstairs to Bethany's room. And then at one point, Bethany also saw that same image. But it's flummoxing to think that they called friends, they called 911 before anybody sort of went to investigate what was happening in that bedroom with the door now open. We always assumed that it was closed and they couldn't get past it.
Yeah, that's definitely a puzzling part of it. But I always assume, you know, you have somebody who's scared, girl, slightly, you know, intoxicated. My own daughter, when my son was playing a prank on her, acting like he was being attacked, him and his mom, Kaylee ran upstairs and hid under the bed and called me at work. So when people are scared and they're you know, they're young, they don't think the same way as a grown adult does. And I think they were just thinking that something bad had happened, but they didn't want to believe it. They weren't really prepared to mentally like accept what was happening. And I totally understand that, because it's not something that we're used to in Idaho. It's not something that is common. It's just unheard of. So I chalk it up to that. And I know that there's a lot of forensic, and these girls had their phones on. I already said way back in the day that you could tell when they went up the stairs and downstairs. This is all laid out. Every step has been retraced. So it didn't make a difference in the bigger picture. And I've always said that there could be blessings for late calls as well, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's also just so jarring to get the detail that the girls were all together up in your daughter's room chatting about, let's all go out again, 2 o'clock in the morning, let's go back to the food truck. And I'm not sure if you heard how I laid it out at the top of the show, but all I can think of is the what ifs, if they had actually decided to go. And I'm wondering how you're processing that information.
I knew a little bit of the details about that. I don't even talk about some of it just because I don't want to hurt some of the people, you know, that are involved in this. If, you know, certain people would have got picked up phones, all those type of things, those are what ifs. But I think what it really goes to your audience is these girls were best friends. And even the last moments of my daughter and Maddie's, they were surrounded with friends and they were in their beds. So just keep that in mind, you know, because there's going to be probably some people are going to try to drag these surviving people through the mud. And up to their very last moments, they were hanging out with these, the people who passed away, you know, planning on doing something fun. And my daughter came down there to hang out with one of those girls. And that's the reality of it. That's the truth of it. Not some of the speculation that you're going to eventually hear about.
Yeah. And shame on those who have cast aspersions on these two surviving roommates who have been to hell and back. I they're still there. They're not back. And how anyone could set upon them with ridiculous conspiracy theories is beyond the pale. There was something that you mentioned, I think, a couple of days ago in an interview that sort of stood out to me. And that was that I think you had a chance to speak with the coroner and got a detail about one of the injuries that your daughter suffered at the hands of this killer. I think it was a punch to the face. Can you tell me what it is that you learned?
I don't go into all the details on it because I want the court to bring it out. I want them to do it. But yes, I feel 2.5 years. The defense has a strategy to have everybody forget. And I'm here to make sure they don't forget. So when I do have to let stuff out, it's because I don't want people to forget that we have a monster. And yes, he one of the girls was a little more intoxicated. He was able to go after that. Maddie May first. And my daughter woke up and he struck her multiple times and broke her nose. And and there's a little bit more details to that, but I leave that to them in case that's something pertinent for them to know and to let them release it. But I'm not going to let anyone forget about what this monster did. And I'll leave it at that.
But they were able to give you that detail that that the killer killed Maddie first and then went after Kaylee second?
Correct.
I think there's a lot of forensics that we're going to learn in this trial. I hope you're going to be okay, you and Christy and the family, when it comes time for those testimony days. The last thing I wanted to ask you about, Steve, is that you've learned that Brian Koberger called out from work the day after these murders. What do you know about that, and how did you hear this?
There's a thing called a Brian tally I've heard about. I've spoken because I was vocal, because I came out. Some people reached out to me. This individual was an employee of WSU. And from there, I learned of some details. So, there was an investigation, an HR type investigation. And I don't know all the details about it, but I do know these girls felt very creeped out. And they talked to people in power, and they said, document it, and they started documenting it. And that's how we know that one of the days, the day after he took that photo where he's acting like he's super confident and got away with murder. He doesn't look sick to me at all. You guys can look at, your audience can go look at it themselves. And I heard that's the only time he ever called in sick as well.
That's unbelievable detail. Steve, I always am very appreciative that you take the time to speak with us. I'm glad you keep your daughter's memory alive and the story alive as well. It's important that nobody forget what happened. Thank you again for this.
Yeah.
Steve Gonsalves joining us from Idaho tonight. We'll continue to follow the details as they keep coming out in these documents. Also ahead, the best cases make you question not only what happened, but even simple things that you thought you knew for sure. Take smartphones, for instance. Surely they can tell us how many steps we take in a day. And if they can do that, they can tell us what time we did a Google search. But in the murder retrial of Karen Reed, it may all come down to a few keystrokes by a friend of the victim who Googled how long it takes to die in the cold. Can a mere digital expert make that friend look like the killer or make Karen Reed look guilty as sin? That's next. If you've heard this before, but timing is everything, right? Especially in broadcasting. But in Karen Reed's second murder trial, timing could literally mean the difference between freedom and a life behind bars. The big issue in that courtroom today was Google. More specifically, what time a critical Google search happened the night Karen's boyfriend, the police officer, was killed. Did it happen at 2:27 a.m.? Or did it happen at 6:23 a.m.? And those 4 hours are suddenly taking days to dissect. Karen says that she did not kill her boyfriend with her SUV. She says somebody who had a beef with him inside that house party killed him and then left his body out on the front lawn to freeze long after Karen had dropped him off. One of those friends inside that party was a woman named Jen McCabe. That's her on the stand right there. She, or whomever was on her telephone, Googled the words, how long to die in the cold. It was a spelling error, but it was basically how long to die in the cold. And that would certainly help to clear Karen Reed, right, if that happened, who was nowhere near the scene at 2:27 a.m. when one expert says that happened. But an expert today told us something that a lot of us don't know. That if you open a browser on your phone at, say, 2:27 a.m., and then you knock off for the night, you fall asleep, and then you start Googling the next morning as soon as you wake up, in that same browser that you had left open for the night before. So you start getting your fingers going at 6:23 a.m. The search that you do at 6:23 a.m. may be logged as having happened the night before when you opened the browser at 2:27 a.m. That is not good for Karen Reed, because that lady on the stand up there, Jen McCabe, she says Karen yelled at her to research dying in the cold that morning as they found his body, which would account for her saying how long to die in the cold, as opposed to I'm skulking around at 2:27 a.m. killing a guy and wondering how long I can freeze him to death. You do not have to host a true crime show to know what's coming here, okay? Battle of the experts. Should be a game show. Battle of the experts. Prosecution experts versus the defense experts. All highly qualified, highly paid. And it's up to this poor jury, hairdressers and mechanics and checkout people. It's up to them to figure out which of these very smart tech nerds to believe. I'm hoping to cut through all of that with my next guest, who I eloquently called a tech nerd. Jake Green is a digital forensics go-to expert. Good to have you back on, and thanks for smiling. So what is a girl to think? I love that expression. If I'm sitting on that jury and I hear two very smart people like you, Jake, telling me two completely different things about technology, which I assume is black and white, what am I supposed to think?
Really, the thing that we have to look at is who's able to forensically validate their evidence. Who's received this evidence? Who can show exactly how are these dates and timestamps pulled out? At a recent Cellebrite conference, I actually got to hear Ian speak on a very similar topic. And one of the biggest slides that stuck out to me was one titled Artifacts Change Constantly. And his slide went on to say that just because it was that way yesterday doesn't mean it's that way today. So we're constantly getting updates for our phones. We're constantly getting updates for our applications. If there's an update and something changes within the way this data is recorded and saved, we have to be able to forensically validate how and why our software is reporting this way. In Ian's talks, he makes it crystal clear that this validation is extremely important. And I think it's things that we've talked about before with you. Digital forensics is not just pushing a button on a piece of software and letting it spit out a report. It's actually diving into the evidence, diving into the data, understanding what our software is actually showing us. And that's what Ian testified about today.
Well, I suspect that the defense expert who has not yet taken the stand, we haven't been into the defense's case yet. We've only just heard cross-examination of prosecution witnesses. But I suspect that, because we've been to the rodeo before, right? We've seen the trial a year ago. We know how this works. I suspect they're going to have a forensics expert who's going to say, no, absolutely not. When you make a Google search, it is logged exactly when you make it, not from when you open your browser the night before. And someone like me who knows squat about digital forensics, I would think that there'd be a clear answer. But are you telling me there just isn't, that artifacts change constantly?
So it can. So one of the key things that I saw in Ian's PowerPoint presentation is an indication that the software versions that he used to test his methodologies and identify when and how are these timestamps created was not the same version that was used. And I think that was the same thing that occurred at the first trial. Is there was an issue that the build version, I think it was different between the tested software and the software that was on the evidence. So if we can't match it perfectly to say that this version of iOS 14 or 15.1.2, whatever, if we can't forensically confirm that it matches exactly, there's always going to be a question mark as to, is it truly accurate how we're interpreting this data?
Jake Green, the minute you start putting dots between numbers, my eyes glaze over, and I don't think I'm different than a lot of jurors. It's possible that all of this stuff will cancel out because it's just too hard. It's too hard to actually make sense of it. Therefore, I'm moving on to the next piece of evidence, and I'll base my decisions on that. But I always love having you on because you're smart and you make it sound as understandable as you can for someone like me. Thank you, Jake.
Thanks, Ashley.
And I pity you for having to do this, facing me and my absolute, you should hear my husband. Oh my God. Okay, coming up next. Next month is going to mark 10 years since a mythical monster from the internet almost cost a 12-year-old girl her life. The creature's name is Slender Man. And while he didn't stab that little girl 19 times because, you know, he's mythical, another 12-year-old friend of the victim did. And now that friend has 1 foot out the door of a mental institution where she was supposed to be locked up for 40 years. Sadly for her, but maybe lucky for the rest of us, getting both feet out that door has been tricky. And that's because of a big red flag, a frightening revelation about that young inmate that might have the rest of us bolting her door shut forever. Stay with us. A fictional boogeyman, a tall, faceless monster in a black suit created by other young people on the internet. His name was Slender Man. And the power he held over young Morgan Geyser was so magnetic that she was willing to kill for him. And she very nearly did. Morgan is not 12 years old anymore. She's almost 23. And she's been locked up in a mental health facility ever since the horrifying day that she stabbed a little friend of hers 19 times. In 2014, Morgan and another little friend named Anissa Weir lured their 12-year-old friend Peyton Lautner into the woods and they jumped Peyton. Here's some of what Morgan told the police back then.
What were you trying to do with her when you stabbed her?
Kill her. I might as well just say it. We were trying to kill her. I don't know why it was necessary that it was her, but it seemed very necessary.
How did you trigger it, Donner?
We said that we were going to go bird watching. People who trust you become very gullible, and it was sort of sad.
Miraculously, despite being stabbed 19 times, Peyton survived. That little 12-year-old girl crawled to a bike path and was rescued by a passerby. Anissa and Morgan were both arrested and tried and both found not guilty by reason of mental disease. They were 12. Anissa was ordered to be confined to a psychiatric facility for 25 years, but she walked out after just 4. Morgan, who did the stabbing, got 40 years. And now Morgan has served 7 years, but she too is on the brink of release. Not full-on freedom, but transfer to a halfway house with round-the-clock supervision. And while that may not sit well with a lot of you watching right now, hold on to your seat for a minute. Because Morgan hasn't been squeaky clean, shall we say, while in lockup. Since the beginning of this year, complaints have surfaced that Morgan had a relationship with a murder memorabilia collector while she was being held in this facility. Her advocates say the relationship was one way and that Morgan ended it. But that person visited. There were also claims that Morgan reads violent crime novels behind bars, including one about organ trafficking, a book called Rent Boy. The defense says that Morgan never tried to hide these books. Today, all sides were back in court so that the judge could sign off on the halfway house transfer. But suddenly, the state raised what they called a very large problem, end quote. The group home that officials had selected is just 8 miles from the victim's house. The victim's mother told the court she's, quote, very concerned. It's an understatement. Apparently the judge was too. So they're all supposed to come back and consider this new placement in a month. But my question is, why is she being considered for release at all, given these predilections that she's got? I'm joined now by my friend Mark Garagos, criminal defense attorney and co-host of the hit podcasts Reasonable Doubt and Two Angry Men. Help me get my head around this, Mark. She's supposed to go away for 40 years. We're into it for 10. She's got a friend who's a murder memorabilia collector visiting her at this facility, and she's reading books about organ transfer. How does she get good time or any time at all?
It's mainly a product of the mental health system. The problem with the criminal justice system is when you try to apply it or put it over the overlay it on a mental health issue, and that's what you have here. And a lot of times the system is ill-equipped to deal with mental health. I can't tell you how many cases where they get pinged back and forth between the criminal justice system and the mental health facility and back and forth. And there's never a real satisfying answer. I think it's probably more fundamental to the problems that we have writ large in society with mental health. Mental health should not be something that's dealt with in the criminal justice system. Clearly here, she was put into the mental health system and then brought back to the criminal justice system to deal with it. And they're just ill-equipped and they don't have the background for it.
Look, I never have been a fan of saying take a 12-year-old who does something horrendous and then lock them away and throw away the key. However, I am also very mindful that this little girl survived, that her mother and her family has lived hell ever since, and knowing that the perpetrators of this hideous crime that they thought was just that she just had to die could be out and walking among them again with these existing mental health conditions. It's very, very upsetting. Does the family have a say here? Does the family of the victim have any say in any of this?
Absolutely. I mean, the family victims have rights. They've got constitutional rights in most jurisdictions. They do have a say, and that's one of the reasons that there was a stop to this, because of the rule, basically, that they can give voice or give a what's normally called an impact. So clearly they can. But on the other hand, you do have this situation where 12-year-olds are not fully formed, and that's not to excuse anything, but it does explain a lot of what's happening here. And it's a horrible case from every different angle. There's nothing satisfying about this case in any way, shape, or form.
I'll tell you what, it would be hard enough if this child and now adult had done everything right and, you know, checked every box and looked perfectly healthy and ready for release after just 10 years of a 40-year sentence. It would be hard enough for that family of the poor, the Lautner family, Peyton Lautner's family, the child who was stabbed. But you have this additional insult, which is that this kid, 23 years old, is visiting with a murder memorabilia aficionado and reading twisted books. That, to me, doesn't sound like somebody who qualifies. How can she?
Well, the murder memorabilia person, at least there's a suggestion that that was unilateral, that that was not something that she had engaged in. I don't know. I'm not close enough to the facts.
He visited.
I haven't talked to the lawyer. Visited. But I don't know if that was more somebody who had kind of insinuated themselves into this for their own purposes, or whether it was somebody who was invited in. Who knows? I mean, that's up to the judge to get to the bottom of that. I imagine the reason the judge pressed pause. I think one of your producers had told me he was retiring in a couple of days. Got the facts straight. Maybe he just wanted to kick the can down the road and let somebody else make the decision.
Retires on Wednesday. You got that right. Mark Garagos, I always love having you on. This was a really upsetting one. I appreciate you giving some context to it. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a tough case.
It really is. It really is. I'll see you again soon, my friend. Okay, coming up next. When it comes to jury duty, anybody out there stepping up? Anybody? Hello? Bueller? Okay, what if you were called for Diddy's trial? Do I have your attention now? Puffy may not have peers in the world of hip-hop, but today a jury of ordinary men and women who'll decide his fate began to take shape. How many do you suppose are going to want to get off this jury? And how many do you suppose are going to want to get on it? That's next. To be on the jury for Sean Puffy Combs. I'd volunteer. His racketeering and sex trafficking trial is now just days away, and jury selection is gearing up. Potential jurors are going to be filling out questionnaires, and the ones who aren't cut after that will be questioned in person by the lawyers and the judge a week from today. If you got a Diddy summons and you cringe at the words freak-offs and baby oil and group sex, the prosecutor wants you, and the defense definitely does not. In fact, Team Diddy wants to use the word swinger during the trial, referring to the defendant's party-hardy lifestyle and alleged fondness for sex with multiple partners. At a hearing late last week, the defense told the judge, and I quote, "There's a lifestyle, call it swingers or whatever you will, that Combs thought was appropriate because it was common. Many people think it's appropriate because it's common," end quote. So the judge allowed it, the term swingers, that is, but he warned that the defense better not name anybody else that might be living that particular lifestyle. And then there's also this. The feds are putting up a roadblock to Diddy's claim that his mental state was clouded by drugs and alcohol. I'll give you a second to get your head around that, right? Opening statements are set for May the 12th. And still to come, a hit and run, a manhunt, and a rock star's wife shot and wounded by police. We have brought you this wild story before, but it now appears all three may have been caused by miscommunication and a mistaken identity. We've got the body cam video and the 911 call when we come back. Hit and run suspects in Los Angeles. And it ended with an armed standoff between police and the wife of a rock star. Actually, it ended with police shooting that rock star's wife in the shoulder. Her name is Jillian Schreiner, and she is married to the bassist in the band Weezer. His name's Scott Schreiner. And now for the first time, we are seeing the officer's body cam video. And it looks like nobody seemed to know who each other was in this wild standoff. See for yourself.
Hey, hold it for me, team. We got out of the suspect.
I have an army resident.
We're in a clear
Hey, put the gun down!
Put it down! Put it down on the ground! Put it down on the ground!
Can I help call for a 415 female with a gun? Be behind the resident's side.
Lay the gun down!
Lay the gun down!
We got one at gunpoint, got an armed suspect. Do not! Man, put the gun down!
Put the gun down!
Put the gun down!
She's walking away.
Party's walking in our direction.
Yeah.
She's armed.
Long gray shirt, black hair, black pants. She has a gun in her hand.
Put the gun down!
Yeah, she lifts that gun. Matt, put the gun down, okay? Hey, you have cover?
Yeah.
I can't see her right now. The gun's not up.
Ma'am, we're trying to help you.
Put the gun down.
Come on with your hands up.
Drop the gun. You're going to get shot. You're getting shot. It's the police.
Put the gun down.
Hey, where's
the gun?
I can't see from what is she doing right now?
You're too late, David.
And she just pointed it. Not at us, but she just lifted it up. Oh, she racked it.
Get down.
Shots fired. The officer needs help.
Holy cow. There's Jillian. After she was shot in the shoulder, she ended up going back into the house. And then she calls 911. And we learned that while the police thought that she was one of the suspects, there she is with the gun, she thought that they, the police, were the suspects. And here's what she told the dispatcher.
She says there were three men and one of them shot her and the cops are looking for him right now. They have their guns out, and, like, I don't know if they found him yet or not, but they told me to not look out the window, so I'm not doing that.
Okay, so he's not in your yard. You don't know that he's there?
Well, he was in my yard because that's where he shot her.
Oh, okay.
He shot from the other side? Okay, he shot from the other side of the gate.
Other side. I had my gun.
Okay.
And he said, put down that gun, put down that gun. He said, put down your gun.
Oh, okay.
So Jillian's got someone else who's made the call, and you can hear her in the background. And because Jillian fired her gun towards the officers, she was booked on suspicion of attempted murder of a police officer and released on $1 million bail, and she's expected to be in court on Wednesday. But as for the real hit-and-run suspects, police did capture one of them after the shooting, but the other two are still on the run somewhere. So pretty action-packed. We'll keep you posted on what happens when she shows up in court. Also, I want to let you know, tomorrow on the show, you got to come back, because what would you do if an 11-year-old is suspected of egging your house, like, for a week? A guy decides to finally tackle her and hold her till the cops get there. But she's 11. And he's charged with battery and false imprisonment. You will not believe the videotape, because they got it all on video. It is crazy, and you got to wonder, what would you do if you were trying to catch the perpetrator? You can